the consequences of our actions.
That's what my whole book is about, is that, you know, all of these individuals are sitting down to a banquet of the consequences of their own actions, which is indeed what we all do, ultimately.
That's acclaimed crime novelist Elizabeth George. We talk with her about her latest Inspector Linley novel, A Banquet of Consequences. And then, just in time for Hanukkah, a new noir collection of stories, Jewish Noir.
The noir sensibility goes back to pre-biblical era. The Jews were always wanderers. Even the name Hebrew means to cross over. You know, someone who's from the other side of the river and crossed over to our side. Yeah, those are the Hebrews. And, you know, a key noir motif is, you know, the individual who is out of place, who is not at home.
That's fiction writer Kenneth Wishnia talking about the new anthology he edited, Jewish Noir. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. Once upon a time, best-selling novelist Elizabeth George got a degree in counseling. But lucky for us readers, instead of treating real patients, she turned her talent for psychological insight into the complex characters that people her fiction. Fans of Elizabeth George have been following her Inspector Linley novels since 1988, featuring the upper-class inspector with a heart of gold and his working-class sidekick, Detective Sergeant Barbara Havers. Now the newest in the series is out, The Banquet of Consequences. It follows the story of one doozy of a dysfunctional family headed by a mother from hell who has a serious personality disorder. Caroline Goldacre makes everyone around her miserable, including her husband, her sons, her daughter-in-law, and her employer, feminist writer Claire Abbott. We've probably all known somebody like Caroline Goldacre and tried to spend as little time as possible with them. It's a tribute to Elizabeth George's genius that the time we spend with Caroline in A Banquet of Consequences is enthralling from beginning to end. Elizabeth George has won numerous awards for her writing, including France's top prize in the genre of police procedurals. Her novels have been made into television series by the BBC and aired on PBS's show Mystery. Well, Elizabeth George, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Elizabeth George, you were born in Ohio, and yet your novels, the Inspector Linley novels, are set in England with just marvelous detail as to English language and customs. Why did you decide to set your mysteries in England, in Great Britain?
Mostly it had to do with the fact that I've had a long time love for Great Britain that began in the 60s when I was first introduced to, you know, to pop culture. And at that period of time in the early 60s and mid-60s, really, everything in pop culture was oriented toward Great Britain. So the music that I first began listening to was British. The fashions were coming over from London in the person of, Mary Quant, who was doing the designing, Twiggy, who was doing the wearing. And motion pictures were introducing us to this great array of British actors who are now everyday names, but in those days, who had ever heard of Michael Caine, Vanessa Redgrave, Lynn Redgrave? You know, but now, of course, they're all very well known. So that sort of was what directed my interest toward England in the first place.
And were you also inspired by the example of Agatha Christie?
No. You know, I haven't read very many Agatha Christie books, and the kinds of books that Agatha Christie wrote aren't the kinds of books that I write. Agatha Christie wrote mystery novels, and I write crime novels, which are quite a bit different from mystery novels. You know, in the mystery novel, first of all, you have a situation where the victim is somebody that you are really not very involved with or asked to care about, and the surrounding characters, too, are there just to serve the interest of the plot. And in a mystery novel, the reader is just given a certain amount of information and has the opportunity to solve the case before the detective does. But in a crime novel, it's a much bigger canvas, and the reader usually has much, much more information than the police ever have. And yet it's the same kind of situation where the reader is asked to try to solve the case, given all this information, in advance of the detective being able to do that.
And I thought I had solved the case, but I hadn't when I read your marvelous new book, The Banquet of Consequences. First of all, I want to ask you about the title. In a quote in the first pages of the book, you quote a writer who said, "Sooner or later, we all sit down to a banquet of consequences." Why did this inspire you to title the book as you did?
Well, you know, I was having a conversation with that writer, Nancy Horan, who lives in the same town I live in on Whidbey Island. And she was writing a book about Robert Louis Stevenson. And that quote is how she says it in the book. Stevenson said it a little bit differently or wrote it a little bit differently. But when she said that, that's what she wanted to call her book that. And as soon as she said the title, I said, "Oh, my God. Oh, that is the perfect title for my new book. May I use that if you end up not using it for your book?" And she said, "Sure." And she called me a few months later and told me that her editor had not liked it as a title for her book, and I was therefore welcome to use it. And, you know, that's what my whole book is about, is that, you know, all of these individuals are sitting down to a banquet of the consequences of their own actions, which is indeed what we all do, ultimately.
Their own actions as well as the actions of others. Someone commits suicide very early in the book, William Goldacre. Tell us a little bit about William, and not why he would be driven to suicide in the larger sense, because we don't want to give that away, but
right.
Why he was driven in right then in that moment. What inspired his act?
I think that in that exact moment, what inspired his act was horror and shame. You know, to have somebody know what was going on with him and what had been behind his behavior for so long. You know, William suffers from a condition called coprolalia, which is sort of looks like Tourette syndrome when you're first glancing at it. Mm-hmm. But unlike Tourette syndrome, which is like the outburst of one, you know, foul word just interjected into a conversation, or just an outburst that is a, you know, sort of a stress and tension reliever, what coprolalia is sort of a nonsense. It's not a nonsense language, but it is the use of regular sentences that don't make any sense and also are quite either scatological or quite sexually offensive. And that's what he has, and that is under conditions of extreme stress, what the reader sees going on with him.
And that is just one of a whole range of psychological disorders, actually, that, you know, are touched upon in this book. In fact, I trained as a clinical social worker, and you did too. You got a degree in counseling psychology. About halfway through the book, it hit me that one of the main characters, William's mother, Carolyn, is the kind of patient that often is known as the therapist nightmare. She has borderline personality disorder. Could you talk a little bit about this disorder and what made this so interesting to you to have a character who embodied it?
Well, in borderline personality disorder, as I understand it, I mean, there is nothing that really can be done for the person chemically. It's a disorder that grows out of the person's past, and a disorder that grows out of the person's inability to really come to terms with their own sort of their own emotionality. And so, in the character of Caroline Goldacre, what I was interested in doing is exploring the manifestations of borderline personality disorder without ever really identifying it. Clearly, Claire Abbott is on the trail of discovering what is exactly going on with this woman, and you know, we certainly have inclinations as to, you know, as the fact that she's suffering from some severe, you know, personality disorder, but we don't necessarily know exactly what it is. So I think what's going on for the reader gets to see it play out as a person who would see it in normal life play out in another individual.
Yes, very much so. I mean, there's only really a hint at it in very much in the latter part of the book there. Claire Abbott, you mentioned her name. Tell us about this character, because she was also a kind of a very interesting counterpoint, I think, to the psychologically dysfunctional other characters. And yet she has her own issues as well.
Yeah, she has her own issues. But what Claire Abbott is in the book is a noted British feminist writer who has had a distinguished career, you know, as a feminist and as a feminist writer, and yet has never made a connection with the larger reading public in the country. And so she would be known to people and certainly known to other feminists, but not necessarily known as a figure that other people would seek out and read, because her previous books have been you know, sort of intellectual polemics. Well, she has finally hit upon a book that appeals to the mass readership of Great Britain, and it is a book called Looking for Mr. Darcy, the myth of Happily Ever After. And her position is that women in Western civilization have been seduced by literature, by film, by books, into believing that, you know, Mr. Right is out there and all they have to do is find him, and at the end of everything they will be living happily ever after. And, of course, as she puts it, the moment Mr. Darcy farted after his marriage to Elizabeth Bennet was probably the moment she realized that, uh-oh, it's not really going to be quite what I thought it was going to be. So, and because she's just this, she's really kind of a colorful character, and she's willing to argue with anyone, anytime, anywhere about this book, she becomes even more well-known and certainly widely read than she was before.
Now, Carolyn Goldacre is her assistant, her personal assistant.
Her personal assistant.
And a difficult personal assistant, more difficult personal assistant I don't think one could find. Everybody wonders, as I did too, why doesn't she fire this woman?
And that's what the people around Claire, you know, her editor, Rory, doesn't understand that either. It's like, why are you keeping this person around? And of course, there is a reason.
Right, there is a reason, which forms part of the plot of the book. But it also seems as if, maybe I'm wrong about this, but that Claire Abbott struggles with a mixture of caution and compassion, that she has some compassion for her, or at least did at a certain point for her personal assistant. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that she makes some excuses for her. But also, though, she's in a position where she has to make excuses for her, because she is, as we see ultimately, that she's protecting herself. You know, when she first meets her, of course, and employs her, she just wants to help her out. And Caroline Goldacre offers to become her house cleaner, I think is how it begins, after they meet at the Women's Institute. And since Claire Abbott needs a housekeeper, she says, oh, sure, you know, yeah, I do need somebody to do that. And then over time, of course, Caroline works her way more and more into the life of the feminist writer.
And, you know, people who have borderline personality disorder generally don't excite compassion. It's very difficult to exercise the kind of compassion that perhaps somebody with this disorder should have. And it's something I struggled with in reading this book as well. I understood where she was coming from, but I still had a lot of trouble with feeling anything positive about her. What about yourself in writing about the character of Carolyn Goldacre? Did you have that struggle?
In feeling compassion for her? Well, I think that ultimately there is a nobility to the character that comes out, you know, in the end of the book. And while that doesn't really save her, and certainly, you know, isn't going to save her in the eyes of the reader, she... understands, you know, what she's done in the past to bring about this situation that has occurred. And while it's impossible for her ever to make the true amends that she needs to make, she certainly does the best she can in that in her, you know, those final moments.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with crime novelist Elizabeth George about her latest book, A Banquet of Consequences. Now, we haven't talked, of course, now about the crime fighters in the book. This is your 19th Inspector Lindley novel. He has his sidekick, Detective Barbara Havers, another main character. She's also not unaffected mentally by her past. Seems to have some issues around attachments to people. Talk a little bit about Barbara Havers and her emotional struggles.
Well, Barbara Havers is a character who has had a lot taken from her through just circumstances of her life and the circumstances of her friendships with people. And early on when we meet Barbara Havers in the series, she's living at home with her parents. She's lost a brother to leukemia when he was quite young. And when we first meet her, we see that her father has pretty serious emphysema, and her mother is really suffering from a form of dementia that is, you know, gets worse as it goes along. So life is sort of being taken from her by Dixie cups, and as we see her come to terms with all of these losses, we, I think, develop a lot of compassion for her. But at the same time, I think that for the reader, there's a great admiration for the fact that she meets all of these struggles in her typical way, which is by kind of powering through things. She forms an attachment with when she's finally able to get her own place after her father dies and her mother has to be placed in a home. Barbara gets her own place and meets this wonderful Pakistani man who is a professor of microbiology and his little daughter, Hadia, and really develops a close friendship with them only to lose them too. So she's really encountered a lot of loss, but she soldiers on and, you know, she's not an unhappy character. She knows that she has to get on with things, and that's exactly what she does.
Yeah, and in fact, she's a tough character. I mean, and I say that in a positive sense. What is it like to work with a character like Barbara Havers over so many decades? What is that process? What have you learned from developing her over these years?
Well, what's really been fun with the character Barbara Havers is that, you know, she starts out in the very first novel as, she's really angry. And she's had difficulty in her job. She has, I think in the beginning, has already been demoted once and put back in uniform. But her superintendent really believes that there's something here worth saving. And he assigns her to work with the one person that she hates more than anybody else at New Scotland Yard, and that is Detective Inspector Thomas Lindley. And she hates him because she doesn't know him. She only sees, as we all do when we first meet somebody, she sees the superficial part. And in his case, he is a sort of a classic British gentleman with the stiff upper lip and everything that goes along with that. But additionally, he is, from a wealthy family and has a title and has all the accoutrements of that title because he's an earl. And so there's just nothing. I mean, she hates him and hates him and hates him. But when she's assigned to work with him, her superintendent says there's a lot you might learn from working with Lindley. And by the end of that first book, you know, she's learned who this man actually is beyond what he looks like and what the accoutrements are of being an earl. And then, so their relationship slowly changes. But the nice thing about their relationship is that they will always be at odds because of their social classes. You know, class is a huge thing in England. It always has been and probably always will be. The class boundaries are more permeable now. I mean, witness Kate Middleton marrying Prince William. I mean, what could be more permeable than, you know, the granddaughter or great-granddaughter of a minor marrying into the royal family? You know, that's just amazing. So they're more permeable now. than they were before those class barriers, but they still exist. I mean, everybody knows, you know, that, for example, to use that example again, that, you know, where Kate Middleton came from, whereas in the United States that would not necessarily be a big thing at all. So they, so Barbara and Lindley still have that conflict between them, but she has evolved and he has evolved into character. They've evolved into characters who love each other and have each other's back. And it's not a romantic love, but it is it's a genuine love of one human being for another.
Well, now I'd like to ask a question more about the craft of writing, because you've written a book on writing fiction, Write Away, it's called, that's W-R-I-T-E, Write Away. And you said that art can't be taught, passion can't be taught, discipline can't be taught, but craft can be taught. And first I want to ask you, discipline can't be taught?
Well, no, I think that a person will, you know, makes a commitment to discipline. And I'm talking about self-discipline, mm-hmm. the discipline to sit down and to day after day, you know, put the pedal to the metal, or is it the metal to the pedal? Well, anyway, I don't know. You know, no, I don't think you can teach that. I think that you can tell people that's what they have to do. Mm-hmm. I think that you can demonstrate it. I think that you can be a model of it. But people do have to make a personal commitment to suit up and show up. You can't really teach that. You can't, you know, force somebody to sit in a chair and write every day. They have to make that decision themselves.
Okay, so now I'm not sure if this is really a fair question, because I'm sure there are many, many skills that you use for the craft of writing. But if you were to pick one or two key skills that you use for the craft of writing, or that you learned and worked at and learned, what would they be?
Well, I think that the first skill that was really, you know, has been really important to me was the ability to create character, and, you know, coming up with a way that I could create character, and in such a way as to make these people real individuals who demonstrate what William Faulkner called the human heart in conflict, and so that I think has been a huge benefit to me. Additionally, I would think that understanding that it is possible to break down the whole system, the creative act itself, to break it down in such a way that as a sort of an organizational freak, the left side of my brain is soothed by organization into kind of letting go so that the right side of my brain can take over, the creative part, the part that recognizes inspiration when it kicks me in the butt. Those two things I think have been real important.
And you organize the novel first? Do you have it all set out in your mind and then go at it, or does it unfold as you write?
It's a combination of both. I mean, the first thing is that, you know, I don't try to hold anything in my mind because the stories are really complicated, and it wouldn't be possible for me to remember everything because of the length of the books and the length of time it takes me to write them. So what I do is, having created the characters in advance, and knowing, you know, the killer, the victim, and the motive, I follow a process. And what the process does is it organizes the entire book for me in sections. It doesn't go, you know, I don't create the entire novel in advance through a step outline and a running plot outline. But what I do is, given my knowledge of where the book is going to begin, and that, you know, a novel can begin at the beginning, after the beginning, or before the beginning. And so I make that decision in advance of, you know, starting to plot out. I know it, you know, I go, okay, well, I can see that this book needs to begin after the beginning, and then go back and pick up what the beginning was. And that's part of the whole process. But then what I do is having chosen who my point of view characters are going to be, I begin looking at the idea of, okay, what would be the first scene in this novel, and from whose point of view is that scene going to be depicted? And that gets placed on a piece of paper that I just cut up scratch paper and make them each piece about the size of a mailing envelope. And so I would write on that, let's say, Lindley comes into the office, meets up with Barbara Havers, is told by Isabel Ardery that Barbara has been transferred to the north of England, let's say. Okay, and that goes on the floor under Lindley's name. And then what I do is I'm looking for causality. So I'm saying to myself, okay, given that that's the first scene, what's that going to cause to happen? And maybe it will cause Lindley's next scene to happen, but maybe Havers is going to be a point of view character and it'll cause Havers' first scene to happen. So going that way, what I do is I try to figure out as many scenes in advance of starting to write as I can. So all of this is, you know, is like it's all intellectual. See, there's nothing really creative about it because I'm engaged in a process. Then I, from that point, I create a running plot outline of however many scenes I've managed to think of. And then once the running plot outline is created, then I get to write. And the beauty of it is that having done all this stuff in advance, the left side of my brain is really content with the organizational process, and that frees me up to be as creative as I want in the real important part, which is the writing. So it's complicated, but it totally works for somebody who has a sort of an obsessive-compulsive personality.
Well, that's terrific. That is absolutely fascinating. I know you have to go now. You have another interview, Elizabeth George. I just totally loved reading A Banquet of Consequences. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
I appreciate the time with you. Thanks very much.
Read an excerpt from Elizabeth George's A Banquet of Consequences at writersvoice.net. Next up, we celebrate Hanukkah with a serving of Jewish noir fiction. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. There's a peculiar brand of humor in Jewish culture that takes its inspiration from the darker side of life. That's probably due to the centuries of exclusion and persecution that Jews experienced. I notice, actually, it's finding a parallel these days in the humor of Muslim comedians for the same reasons. That tragic sensibility happens to lend itself perfectly to the genre of noir fiction. Now, award-winning mystery writer Kenneth Wishnia has brought together a collection of 32 stories by both Jewish and non-Jewish writers that explores classic noir themes through the lens of Jewish life, history, and tradition. The writers in Jewish noir include such luminaries as Marge Piercy and Harlan Ellison, and the writing spans from the early 20th and into the 21st centuries. I started out by asking Kenneth Wishnia, what exactly does he mean by the term Jewish noir?
So two main strands. I mean, one in the 20th century in Hollywood, a great many Jewish writers, screenwriters, and then emigre directors were, you know, really crucial in creating the noir sensibility. And, you know, it's not for nothing that, a lot of these directors, you know, fleeing persecution in Europe, you know, came to the U.S. and did a bunch of films about dark shadows and being betrayed and, being arbitrarily chewed up by a system. And it's not for nothing that a great many of the blacklisted writers of the 50s were actually left-leaning Jews who dared to write about the dark side of the American experience. So, you know, you got that happening in the 20th century. But, what struck me, and again, that I've had to sort of demonstrate, and I do in the introduction to Jewish noir, is that, you know, I really feel like the noir sensibility goes back to pre-biblical era. You know, that during my research for my current novel In Progress, which is a Jewish-themed historical set in the world of ancient Israel, that the Jews were always wanderers, that even the name Hebrew, you know, from Ever, means to cross over. You know, someone who's from the other side of the river and crossed over to our side. Yeah, those are the Hebrews. So just even the name has this sense of we're not from here. And, you know, a key noir motif is, you know, the individual who is out of place, who is not at home, whose life is actually unsettled and unstable. And that really is the defining Jewish condition from, you know, even from almost before we had a tribal identity. And, even Moses, you know, surely the most important figure in the Hebrew Bible, or what Christians call the Old Testament, not only does he refuse the call at first, but also he is described as always feeling a little bit out of place, you know, being a stranger in a strange land and, you know, never being at home and wandering in the wilderness. And I think part of the noir experience for him is how ungrateful everyone is. If you've read Exodus, you know that, you know, he carries them out of Egypt, and then they complain, "Oh, did you bring us to the, you know, to the Red Sea just to have us killed? Oh, you know, where's your God now?" You know, they get to the other side and they say, "Where's the fresh water?" Oh, you know, they're constantly complaining. But for me, the real summation, the culmination of, you know, Moses' noir experience at the end of the books of Moses, at the end of Deuteronomy, when he finally leads the Israelites up to the steps of Moab, and they're overlooking the promised land across the Arabah Valley. And then God says, "You may look at the promised land, but you may not enter it." Mm-hmm. And, you know, Moses, of course, dies on the other side, never enters the promised land, and is buried in an unmarked grave. And, you know, that's a key noir motif. So, you know, for some people, you know, noir is relentlessly bleak. You know, you have characters that are already doomed on page one, and it only gets worse, which, you know, is a noir motif. But, you know, for me, one of the things that makes noir work is, but people have this hope. They have this dream. They think, no, we're gonna kill your husband and get away with the insurance money, and then we're going to have this great life together. So, yeah, most people would not necessarily see an immediate parallel to the Hebrew Bible, but I do. And, you know, and it goes on from there.
So, in a way, what you're saying is noir has, and Jews certainly do, and I count myself among them, have a tragic sense of life, and that one element of this is fatalism. Talk about this. You know, it's not to say that other peoples don't, but this is definitely a feature of both what we see in this book, Jewish Noir, as well as in the experience of Jews growing up. I mean, I certainly remember when I was a child, it was relentlessly drilled into me, the tragic sense of life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and as you say, fatalism. You know, in that sense, our ancient literature, you know, shares some of that with the ancient Greeks and even, you know, the Sumerians also. I mean, when sometimes when people ask me, you know, because they always ask writers, they sort of like, "Oh, what writer influenced you the most?" And, you know, I say, well, start with the Epic of Gilgamesh and read everything else since then, because, you know, basically be voracious and read everything. And, yeah, I mean, you know, I think one thing that I really learned on the research for this was comparative research has shown considerable parallels between the laws of Moses and other existing Babylonian laws. And especially, yeah, the Sumerians have this sense of people die. You know, the Epic of Gilgamesh, you know, Gilgamesh's best friend dies and he despairs over this and goes in search of, you know, he's told, well, if you want to find the secret of life, there's this one guy who's the only one person who hasn't died, and that's, you know, Utnapishtim, and he lives at the end of the world, you know, across the lake of eternal death kind of thing. And, you know, among other things, Gilgamesh is told, okay, sure, you know, you want to live forever, there's this flower of immortality that grows at the bottom of the lake. So he ties some stones to his feet, you know, jumps out of the boat, and sinks down to the bottom, grabs the flower, unties the stones, and floats back up to the surface. And a water snake lunges out of the water and snatches the flower of immortality out of his hands, sloughs off its skin, and slithers away. So, you know, there's a motif that might sound a little familiar. You know, gee, we had the promise of eternal life in paradise held out in front of us, but a snake took it away. But, you know, one of the things I discuss is Koheleth, that the Christians call Ecclesiastes, better known under that name, where, you know, in the standard King James translation, he begins by saying, "Vanity, vanity, all is vanity." Mm. And, you know, maybe in the 16th century, I mean, early 17th century, when they made the translation, the word meant something different. But, you know, certainly modern readers of that, you know, it lends itself very easily to a Christian interpretation, like, oh, yes, we're all sinners, you know, before God. Vanity is one of the deadly sins. And, you know, yeah, we humans are natural-born sinners. And, you know, one of the things I've learned during the research is that the actual word he's using is hevel, which means mist. And, you know, what he's actually saying is, what's the point? Fatalism. You know, the rich man and the poor man both die. You know, the righteous man and the evil man both end up dead. So, yeah, you know, at the time that Ecclesiastes was written, apparently, you know, Jewish doctrine did not believe in a joyous afterlife. It shared the same sense of a fairly mundane existence in the underworld that the Greeks and the Sumerians had. And so, yeah, you know, Ecclesiastes is basically saying, enjoy what you've got now, because this is it. And they do look around and see, you know, injustice. And, you know, you'll see that in Job as well. You know, Job directly confronts God saying, I look around and I see righteous men suffering and evil men triumphing, and this isn't the way it's supposed to be. And you know, it's very telling that God doesn't really answer that directly. You know, God shows up and basically says, you know, where were you when I made the mountains, right? Don't ask these questions. And so yeah, I think we're getting fairly deep into comparative religion here rather than the anthology of Jewish noir. But yeah, if I were to really oversimplify, the typical Christian belief is like, all you have to do is accept Jesus as your personal savior, you know, and you're good. Good to go. And whereas in the Hebrew Bible, you know, you can live a thoroughly righteous life and, you know, give tzedakah, alms to the poor, and you can still end up being screwed. So yeah, there's a fatalism there. So, you know, and this is not speaking of all the, you know, blood libel charges in the Middle Ages and et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it runs through Jewish history for millennia, not just centuries.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Kenneth Wishnia about the anthology he's edited, Jewish Noir. And, you know, there are also some other themes of the book, but before we go on to those, give us an example from a Jewish Noir that you think really expresses and is emblematic of this fatalism.
I mean, it's quite a shift because, you know, here we are talking about sort of the roots of Judaic noir in the biblical era, and yet all the stories in Jewish noir are contemporary. They're, you know, 20th century or 21st century. Really, the oldest one is actually Yenta Serdotsky's story, which was published in the foreword in Yiddish in 1912, and is being, first of all, it's never been reprinted, so it's being published for the first time and appearing for the first time in English. And even that one, you know, it's an immigrant, you know, Yenta Serdotsky herself was, you know, fairly radical woman from Yiddish-speaking originally from Eastern Europe and, you know, comes to the U.S. with this radical community. And I think, you know, you can sense that there was all this excitement when people were young in this new land, and this new land was still, you know, still in formation. There was a chance to remake it, you know, in this way that was different from old Europe and, you know, the oppressive aristocratic system of, you know, Tsarist Russia or something. And, of course, that does not happen. So even in the very first story, the one that, well, I mean, chronologically, the oldest story in here, you see this disillusion, and it happens in only 15 years that one of the main characters is supposed to be this young radical woman who's in her late 20s, and a mere 15 years later, you know, she's in her early 40s and has sort of been abandoned by her old comrades for the crime of growing old. So, and not that old. Yeah, she's all of 43, according to the chronology of the story. So there's an example right there.
Yeah, and that story also typifies what I remember as the real, you know, the Jewish tradition that I grew up in, which was a tradition of talking about working class heroes, of social commentary, of the fight for justice, something which, you know, seems to me has really gone away. And I think I'd like you to talk a little bit, first of all, about this thread that runs through so many of these stories of social justice.
Right. Well, again, that also has roots in ancient Israelite tradition. You know, the prophets are constantly complaining about this. And that, too, is unique in terms of the, you know, again, going back to the ancient world, but in the official annals of all of those ancient Near Eastern cultures, you know, the Hebrew Bible is unique in criticizing its leaders and kings. You know, if you read Egyptian and Assyrian annals, you know, every king is always glorious, you know, the son of the gods, and is always triumphant in battle, even when history shows he actually lost that battle. Well, no, he won it in the annals. And, of course, anyone with, you know, even passing familiarity with the, you know, the Book of Kings in the Bible knows that, you know, it sort of says, and then came so-and-so, and he did not do what was right in the eyes of God. And, yeah, you know, we really have this thousands-year-old tradition of critiquing our leaders for not living up to the standards of the Torah. You know, the Torah calls for righteousness, and, you know, we have this whole group that does critique it. And again, they're not always welcome, their critiques. The prophets there are treated fairly badly a lot of the time. And, you know, in some ways, yes, I would argue that, you know, in today's America, you know, a lot of literary fiction has abandoned what used to be one of its roles as reportage of, you know, what's going on out there in the lives of others. You know, you think of the 1930s with novels like The Grapes of Wrath. And, you know, in some ways, a lot of the crime writers are now the ones who are reporting back on, you know, the way in which society is falling short of its ideals, mm-hmm. you know, and Jewish crime writers in particular at the moment. You know, I think, you know, although not all, you know, not all the contributors to this volume are Jewish. I would like to point that out. You don't have to be Jewish to write Jewish noir or to read it. So, you know, we did try to broaden that. But yes, I do think the history of social commentary, you know, isn't just going back to, say, the radicals of the 1930s, or, you know, even earlier eras. You know, it's in there in the Hebrew Bible.
I'm thinking one of the stories, I think this is written by your brother, as a matter of fact, by Stephen Wishnia, The Sacrifice of Isaac. This is a story that's got a very contemporary concern. It's really about gentrification in Brooklyn. This takes place a little bit earlier than right now, when Williamsburg was being gentrified. And it's a story about, in some ways, I think, of the two sides of the Jewish tradition or idea. One, which is, I mean, it's a social commentary on gentrification, and the, you know, the whole idea of that we were just speaking about of social justice. And on the other hand, the bad guys in this are the Orthodox Jews, who have been very much involved in the gentrification and the huge real estate development in New York, and in doing so are really getting rid of neighborhoods, of mowing down, you know, both communities and artists in their wake. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about these tensions between, let's say, social justice and making money.
Sure. Yes, this is a huge topic, but we'll just skim the surface a bit. First of all, yeah, I mean, my brother writes from lots of experience. He's also, you know, he's not in there just because he's my brother. He is an award-winning journalist and writer on his own, and he also does specialize in housing issues. He actually edits the Met Council on Housing's monthly publication, Tenant. So, you know, he's been writing about housing issues for many, many years, and you know, I think one of the things you see in his story is, sure, you know, the power brokers make decisions, and, you know, some of them might even be, in some sense, for the good. Oh, we're going to clean up this, you know, abandoned neighborhood and, you know, make it habitable again. But, you know, one of the things he shows is, you know, decisions made on high, you know, often crush little people who are not visible. And even that, again, the prophets talk about. I mean, you know, one of the prophets complains that, you know, the king wanted a piece of property and there was a poor man working the property. Yeah, he just took it. So, you know, you actually have, you know, unfair land acquisition, you know, happening in the Hebrew Bible. But, you know, a key thing, again, that I feel I really discovered while doing, you know, research recently is that this is not a new phenomenon. There have been two sides, of course, many more, but, you know, certainly two sides to Jewish culture for as long as there have been Jews. In other words, you know, there have been sort of more liberal, universalist, inclusive Jews and more conservative, exceptionalist, and exclusive Jews for as long as there have been Jews. You know, to bring it into the modern era, yeah, you're talking about the difference between social justice and making money. And in a sense, that really is the two stereotypes of Jews that are most prominent, certainly in the U.S., you know, dating from, you know, the age of the great wave of immigration, you know, from 1880 to World War I, is exactly this contradictory stereotype. You know, they are either wild-eyed Russian radical, you know, anarchist Jews who have come to smash capitalism, or, yeah, they're bank-owning Rothschilds who actually want to control world finance or something. And, you know, to the extent that any stereotype is based on some fact, they are both true. You know, we've had this difference, you know, even in in the Maccabean Revolt, since today is Hanukkah, and the day that you broadcast it will also be Hanukkah, a lot of Jews were perfectly willing to assimilate into the Greek style. So, you know, yes, Hanukkah is about how the Greek conquerors enforced their rules and, you know, outlawed reading the Torah and, of course, put idols up in the temple and, you know, took the Maccabees to, you know, smash the idols and purify the temple and rededicate it with the miracle of 8 days of oil. But, you know, what you know, we don't always look at is that there were a lot of people who seemed perfectly happy to assimilate with the new overarching culture. So, yeah, you know, you have those two sides. So the, in the sense that, you know, in any of these eras from ancient Israel on when, okay, we no longer had our own kingdom, but we're subject to, you know, other empires, you know, throughout Europe, European history as well, there have always been sort of well-placed Jews who were perfectly happy to go along, you know, with the system because, you know, it was profitable, you know, versus others who railed against it. So, yes, yeah, so there's a lot to say about that.
Yeah, and actually, sometimes I think it's, I mean, Jews are not the only ones who have made huge amounts of money by exploiting other people, not by a long shot, but that it's actually the other side of it, the social justice tradition, is to think that, okay, if we believe in social justice, then how is it okay that these other Jews are exploiting people? So it's almost a contrast that sharpens that distinction.
Right. As I'm going to forget the exact reference because this was something that, you know, I found in research for my previous novel. I think it's, I do think it's Talmudic, though, if not Mishnah. But essentially, there's this rabbinic admonition of don't cheat a Gentile. It makes all of us look bad. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is this, like, be honest in business, you know, with Jews, but especially with non-Jews. Because, yeah, you cheat them, you know what's going to happen. We're all going to look bad. And, of course, you know, the commandment that's repeated the most in the Torah is don't hate the stranger, for you are strangers in Egypt.
We're talking with Kenneth Wishnia about Jewish Noir. It's an anthology he edited with 32 short stories from both Jewish and non-Jewish writers exploring noir themes through the lens of the Jewish experience. We are at a moment also where all these themes are coming up again. I mean, today as we're talking, it is the day after Donald Trump has said if he were president, he would not allow Muslims in America. Right. He wants Muslims to, you know, have to carry around identification. I mean, these are shadows, echoes of, to anybody, but especially to those of us who are Jewish, just is enough to send a chill up the spine. And your book does talk a lot about, you know, there are stories, really powerful stories. I'm thinking of Harlan Ellison's final shtick is one of the most powerful that talk about the anti-Semitism. So I wonder if you could talk about that and then also maybe make a connection, a parallel to what's happening today.
Well, I do. It's not just theoretical. I do face it in my classrooms. My day job is I teach English at Suffolk County Community College. And while the, you know, SUNY Stony Brook nearby was 50% Jewish back in 1970, you know, it's 50% Asian today. You know, there's been this huge shift. In my classrooms, I think the largest so-called minority are Latinos. And we are actually reading some of the stories from this volume. And one thing, as editor, I was actually surprised that three authors, in addition to Harlan Ellison, you know, chose to write about being bullied for being Jewish in post-war America, you know, in suburbia or small-town America. So, you know, what makes that, of course, noir is this is supposed to be a golden age of some kind. I mean, a lot of people look back to sort of the 50s as this golden era. You know, we had just won the war. You know, U.S. industry was exporting all over the world, and yet, it wasn't such a golden age if you were, I don't know, an educated woman who didn't want to stay at home and go slowly crazy of boredom, or if you were black and wanted to vote in the South, or, you know, gays were still expected to be in the closet. But so, you know, I did not expect that many people to write about being bullied for being Jewish in, you know, what, as they say, people look at as a sort of golden age of, you know, the American century, as it's called. But one of the things I have stressed to the Latino students in my classes is I have said, okay, you know, you might not relate specifically to the Jewish stuff, But surely your group is going through the same thing right now, you know, two generations after most of these stories take place, and surely you can relate to that. And, you know, yeah, it is a sad commentary that overt systemic anti-Semitism has, you know, largely disappeared from the United States. I mean, you only get a few, like, crazy old neo-Nazis actually targeting Jews, you know, violently. But it's just the target is merely shifted. Mm-hmm. So that, yeah, I think, you know, a lot of my Latino students are you know, experiencing the kind of discrimination that we describe in Jewish noir. And yes, some of the rhetoric, some of the demagogic rhetoric from some candidates sounds disturbingly like some of the same demagogic rhetoric from the 1930s, you know, from various figures. So, yeah, I think, you know, yeah, all Jews should feel uncomfortable when somebody condemns an entire group of people, even if it's not us. I think that's a very Jewish thing to think, yeah, well, we're next on the list. You know, once you start going down that road of sort of, oh, yeah, this group will never fit in and they shouldn't be allowed to, you know, become American. You know, I have worked on the great wave of immigration and other periods, and basically, and again, as I'm sure most of your readers know, that same rhetoric was being used against the Irish 160 years ago. They're so alien. Oh, they're papists. They're going to be loyal to the Pope and not to America. I mean, is there anyone alive in the country today who thinks that the Irish will never be patriotic Americans? But it was being said back then. And of course, yeah, in the 1890s, it was our turn, along with the Italians and some other groups. I mean, there's a noir element there, too, this kind of dark Groundhog Day thing of just sort of every generation seems to forget that they used to say Group X would never fit in, and then they do, and then another generation goes by and, oh, it's Group Y now, you know. And so, yeah, we're facing that. And, yes, it's disappointing, but, yeah, there's an element of noir in that, in the sense that if this is still happening, one can't help but worry that it will never end. If we haven't learned yet, you know, when are we going to? So, yes.
And would you say maybe that's why volumes like Jewish Noir can be so relevant? One group's experience is a lens on all groups' experience.
I would hope so, anyway. Yes, that's why we did stress, like, you don't have to be Jewish to write Jewish noir. And I think some of the best stories in here are by some of the non-Jews, because they can relate to that. But yes, I would hope other groups would pick it up and understand that. I guess, you know, there are all kinds of American immigrant experiences, and there are always exceptions, you know, and you know, things are worse. I mean, one of the things I mentioned in the introduction is, like, yes, okay, for most of us, you know, we've assimilated. I mean, we're white now, even though we weren't necessarily a couple of generations ago. And, you know, yes, we're likely to survive an encounter with the local police who are unlikely to mistake us for dangerous armed criminals. You know, we don't have to necessarily experience that noir aspect of American culture. And yet, you know, among those who hate us and attack us, you know, yes, there are lies being told about, you know, Latino immigrants, you know, that they don't pay taxes or things like that, when, of course, that's insane. But, you know, the Jews seem to be the only group that still have to contend with things like the blood libel. I mean, how many of these groups that are discriminated against have to deal with a 900-year-old illogical and nonsensical lie? You know, so there's that weird aspect. Again, as I say, you know, the noir angle is, this beast will never die. I mean, if it hasn't died yet. So yes, that's some mighty noir territory there.
And there's one story, I think, though, that sure expresses all of that, and yet there is an element of rising up in spite of the despair, rising up against it, and that's Twisted Shiksa by Jedediah Ayers.
Oh, sure.
I mean, there are references to, you know, resurgent neo-Nazi ideology that's going on right now. There's reference to the Black Lives Matter movement. There are Jews and Muslims who are working together there, and there's a guy who decides to take the battle right into the heart of the enemy.
Right, and Jedediah Ayers actually is in St. Louis, and Ferguson does appear in his story. And Jedediah is also one of the non-Jews in there, so, you know, I want to stress, yeah, I thought it was a great and very provocative story, and it has humor in it, which is something we need to mention. Like, yes, there's actually humor in here, and of course that's also very Jewish too, you know, laughter through tears, dark humor. You know, not slapstick put-down humor. And you see that in some of the stories. I think David Liss's story, I won't give anything away, but let's say there's an actual murder in here that made me laugh in David Liss's story, just the way it happened. So that's some black humor.
Well, Kenneth Wishnia, your collection of short stories is Jewish Noir, just in time for the holidays for us to tell our listeners about it. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. You still there?
Yes, yes. Or do you want me to sign off by saying thank you for having me or something?
You don't have to.
I wasn't sure if you had the last word or not, you know. But yes, thank you for having me. And available now for Hanukkah from PM Press.
In addition to editing the anthology Jewish Noir, Wishnia is the author of several works of fiction and short stories, including 23 Shades of Black, which was nominated for the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best First Novel. You can find a link to PM Press, publisher of Jewish Noir, on writersvoice.net. And finally, something else for our web visitors. I've been thinking a lot this Hanukkah about the parallels between the Jewish and Muslim experience, especially their common experience as victims of religious and cultural hatred. These thoughts have been especially painful in light of Donald Trump's talk about banning Muslims from the U.S. because of the horrible actions of a few Muslim individuals in Paris. It's just too resonant of Nazi Germany in the 1930s. Back in 2002, I went to live in France in the southern region of Provence for 8 months. It was, of course, post-9/11, and Provence's large Muslim population was feeling the heat even then. The right-wing National Front was on the rise. They just came in first place in the first round of regional elections in France now. But back in 2002, that was still unthinkable. But it wasn't just Muslims who were the target of xenophobia. As a Jew, I also was quite aware of pervasive subtexts of anti-Semitism in France, not as virulent as those against Muslims, but present nonetheless, and with a long, long history in that country. I wrote a piece about all that, and this week I updated it a bit. It's posted on the Writer's Voice website. Take a look. I'd be interested to know what you think. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.